This is Payments Ground Game, where we go under the operational hood of payments ISOs. Let's take a deep dive into the tactics you can use to strategically scale performance and your bottom line. Welcome to another episode of Payments Ground Game. I'm your host, Elena Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Smith. And today we have a special guest, Ken Musante. He's the founder and president of Napa Payments Consulting and brings 3 decades of experience with issuing, acquiring, ISOs, payment facilitators, fintechs, and card network rules. He provides consulting services to assist merchants and platforms select the right payment solution and integration to maximize capabilities and minimize both costs and regulatory complexity. He also provides expert witness consulting for complex civil and criminal cases. So welcome, Ken. We're happy to have you here.
Well, thank you both for the opportunity to join you and your forum. I sincerely appreciate that. You're right. I'm old. A lot of people that I encounter now in the payments are younger than the number of years that I have in payments. And so I consider my experience and the opportunities I've had has made me extremely fortunate to have those experiences. I started out on the issuing side, working for a money center bank right out of college, and I did that for 5 years before having the opportunity to start from the germination of the seed, a payments acquiring organization within a small community bank. And I had the opportunity to run that for 15 years, for the first 10 of that for the community bank that I started it under, and then had the opportunity to run that for 5 years as a standalone company owned by a larger bank. And then, unfortunately, during the Great Recession, when that bank failed, I helped with the migration of that business from the FDIC, and so worked for the FDIC for a short period of time, and then integrated the business into Monero Solutions, which eventually became Worldpay. After the integration, I left and started a direct-to-merchant ISO and had the honor of doing that for 9 years before going to work for a PayFac, which is now part of a very large money center bank, and got to ride shotgun with the engineering team as a product manager, helping them to build out the product plan to integrate the PayFac card not present solution into the bank's card present solution. So yes, I'm old, and yes, I've got to see a lot of things.
Ken, don't feel alone. There's several of us out there that, you know, have been around for quite some time. You're not the only one.
But I love all the experience in the banking world, because today our topic is all about acquiring sponsor banks. What role do they play? How does risk management play into this? How does liability work? Some of the recent events that we've seen with sponsor banks. So excited to have this discussion with you because you have direct experience here. So let's just start with acquiring sponsor banks and talking about the role that they play, why we need them, their connection to the card brands and issuing banks. Can you kind of just set the stage for us in how that works and what role they play in payment processing?
So absolutely. So we're talking about the U.S. There's some different rules for regions outside of the U.S., but within the U.S., only a financial institution, a issuer or acquirer, may be members of Visa and MasterCard. And anyone else that's a part of the ecosystem has had to have been sponsored by a financial institution. And certainly a bank can delegate authorities down to other entities, but it's the bank that remains responsible and liable. In fact, if you look at the merchant agreements for entities that are using third party, it says right on the agreement, only a bank may approve the merchant application. And it talks about some of the other duties that the bank has to perform. One of those is managing and holding the merchant funds and reserves. In select instances, with the relatively new category of payment facilitators or PayFacs, they can hold and manage merchant money. But to do that, you need a money transmitter license in 49 of the states that require it. And most PayFacs look at that and say, you know what? That's too much of a lift for what I want to do. And they'll, even in those situations, allow the bank to be the holder of those funds.
It is entertaining that, you know, you always go through the negotiations with, let's call them ISOs, whether you are the financial institution. I have been the financial institution before, just like you have, Ken. And you go through these negotiations and everybody talks about, I have to have ownership. The contracts have to be in my name, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have to sit down and kind of state the obvious, not really the obvious, but you have to state that, look, it doesn't matter what we all want to think. At the end of the day, the ownership of the accounts is always going to be with the bank. The bank is always going to have to be a participant in the merchant agreement, and there's no way to get around that. We, as ISOs, are not financial institutions. We cannot be members of the card networks.
And on the flip side of that, the ultimate liability flows to the bank, which we'll get to that in a little bit, but they both kind of go hand in hand. All right, let's talk about risk management and the things that come into play in the ways that we manage risk with acquiring sponsor banks. So some of the areas are anti-money laundering, Know Your Customer, the Patriot Act, and then also compliance with the card brand rules. Can we talk about the three of those areas and how we work with sponsor banks to make sure that we're complying with all three of those areas?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the anti-money laundering and Know Your Customer and the Patriot Act, right? That's just the ante. You've absolutely have to comply with those. Card brand rules are very important, but if you look at and compare, well, rules set up by the federal government versus rules that are set up by for-profit companies, the rules set by the federal government are always going to be more important than rules set by Visa, MasterCard. Obviously, violating a rule set by the federal government, you're talking about criminal, you know, potential criminal liability. And so, for the most part, within our industry, that has been widely accepted. And for the most part, everybody has appropriate standards in place that everybody understands and adheres to.
Yeah, these are the types of things that we talk about all the time when we're discussing underwriting with others on, you know, pre-vetting what the business is that you're bringing into the shop. And everybody complains about, oh, I don't want to go get a driver's license. How can I, you know, and then you have to explain to them, look, this is not a card brand requirement. This is a banking federal government requirement that you have to know who your customer is. Now, one of the forms of figuring that out is a driver's license or a Visa. There are other ways to do that now, and it's gotten a little more sophisticated, but most folks don't understand. It's not Ken, you and I that are deciding what is going to meet that requirement. It's going to be the acquiring bank to which we're riding with. You and I have very little say in that. We can come back and suggest, hey, maybe we could use another product like Ideology that does a third-party verification to pass for that. And the bank may say, yes, we're comfortable with that. Or they may say, no, we're not comfortable with that because we have federal auditors come in here. And when they're here and they're beating on my neck and they're asking me to show them how I am providing proof of Know Your Customer, you're not here. I'm here. So that's where people don't understand. They think, Ken, that the ISO, such as Secure Bank Card, sets that rule. It does not. It's our acquiring bank, Synovus. And it's really their tolerance level with how do they want to handle that in their audits that sets that stage.
With regards to some of the automated and progressive underwriting tools, I actually think that there's some out there that are better than the manual intervention. You have to have some manual oversight. But would you agree with that, or would you disagree and think that the automated tools are insufficient?
No. I believe the automated tools are much better. The question is not really, is the automated tool better? It's getting the person at the financial institution that's responsible for that oversight to agree with you on that. And the reason I say that is, you know, it's somebody that's been at the bank and this is the way they've handled their audits for 25 years. They don't want to handle it any different. They know that if they provide a copy of a driver's license, that everybody gets off their back. They've never come to that meeting before and provided an alternative, so they don't know what the reaction is going to be. So it's fear of what is the reaction going to be and am I going to get that reaction in an audit that I think causes some of those things that are much better not to be adopted.
One of the things that I think partners need to do before even having the contractual discussions is understand the type of partners that they're working with, right? The ISV or the fintech needs to interview the bank and make sure the tools that bank are going to be is using and is used to using is in line with the way that the fintech has to operate, and try to not work with a bank that's going to have to completely change their process. In doing so, they're ultimately going to be paying more.
Absolutely. And so many of us get hung up on what's the fee to use this bank rather than how well do I work with the bank and my business model? How well are we going to work together? How much trust is between us? How do we align? That's so much more important than, you know, half a penny on sponsorship cost. so many people just chase down the wrong things.
Yeah, it gets back to that same old saying that we have over and over again, which is, look, the difference between your business being successful is not the difference between 5 cents and 4 cents for an auth. That's not what's going to make your business successful. If you think that is the difference in your business being successful, you are in for a real rude awakening, because that's probably going to be the least determining factor that you have as you grow in this business.
I have a question that you might be able to answer, Ken, and that is, how much variation do you see? We only work with a single sponsor bank, so I'm only familiar with that single sponsor bank and the way that they like to do business and the tools that they like to see us use in underwriting and risk monitoring. How much variation do you see out there amongst sponsor banks in their comfort level with the practices that they have for AML and for Know Your Customer, et cetera?
So that's a good question, right? Because when you think about the number of third parties that are looking for sponsorships, looking to get connected to a financial institution, then you look at the number of banks that offer that, there's way more third parties than there are banks. And so you worry about some of that imbalance within our industry when some of this the sponsorship side changes. There is a very significant variation into the technology that each of these banks bring to bear. I don't think it changes that much with what their expectations are with AML and KYC, right? I think Kevin phrased it well, that it's an expectation that every bank has, but there's absolutely a wide deviation in terms of how they're going to solve for that. And some of them have an aversion to technology because they can't manage it. They don't have the internal technology to manage the oversight that it would require if you're going to be using some type of automated solution, right? They have to ensure that they're controlling and auditing whatever it is that their third party does. If they don't have that in place, then they're defaulting to, you know, perhaps what they've grown up through the bank knowing, which is the manual process.
Well, and Ken, I think that's a very good point. If you have an acquiring bank that they're the ones going through the audit, but they've got multiple relationships with ISOs that are performing underwriting in those relationships, one of their fears is ISO A is doing KYC or Know Your Customer one way, ISO B is doing it a different way, ISO C is doing it a different way. So when they get into the audit, they don't have consistency across all of their customers, which really to the feds, that doesn't, you know, they look at it as the bank. The bank doesn't have consistency.
So years ago, I haven't seen this nearly as much, but years ago, there would be a large bank that had many third parties it was sponsoring. And it would run into a specific issue with a merchant, and the card brands would come down. They would enforce some type of compliance over this third party and the merchant. The merchant would eventually be closed. It would then open up under that exact same bank, but with a different ISO. And you know, the card brands would get furious because they'd say, look, guys, this is the same financial institution. But because the bank didn't have visibility across the different third parties, they didn't understand that was happening.
I think it comes back to that old adage that I pulled from college football that we hear all the time, institutional control. Does that financial institution have control over the parties that are working underneath them? Just like in college football, we hear the NCAA coming down like a hammer because some coach went off and sent some kid a text when he shouldn't have sent him a text. And what do they say? There was no institutional control.
So absolutely. So I think that, you know, that's coming into, I don't think we're seeing those level of issues that we had in the past.
I do think it's funny, though, that you still have a majority of the acquirers out there today are meeting these requirements with a copy of a voided check and a copy of a driver's license, which I'm not here to say whether that is right or whether that is wrong. But I will tell you, out of all the underwriting documents that we receive on a daily basis, the two easiest items to, with today's technology, manipulate, change, fake, whatever you want to call it, it's a driver's license and a voided check.
Well, that's another reason why I think the automated validation tools are so much better and are going to continue to outpace any other way.
No, agreed. Agreed.
All right. That kind of lends itself to the next topic that I want to cover, which is liability and how liability flows between an ISO, the sponsor bank. When something happens, let's first just talk about a financial loss, okay? And let's say we have a large merchant where there's a financial loss. Can you walk us through how that plays out and whose liability that is and how it starts and where it finishes if it's uncovered?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, it starts with the merchant, right? They're the ones that signed the agreement, and they're the ones that said, yes, I'll take responsibility for this. And then the next step in that is the personal guarantee that is typically, not always, but typically associated with a merchant agreement. And, you know, oftentimes you'll hear the inquiry, why do you need a personal guarantee? Well, the reason you need a personal guarantee is because typically in a closely held business, that person is involved in the day-to-day management of that business. And so if they're not willing to personally sign on to something where they're spending the majority of their professional time and they see on a daily basis what's going on, you know, as the underwriter, you're going to say, well, why is it that you're asking me to backstop something that you're not willing to backstop? The next entity that would be responsible in a situation where you have the acquirer, a third party, you know, ISV, PayFac, whoever it is, and the merchant is that third party. They're the ones that typically go to the financial institution and said, okay, look, we're going to take a larger share of the revenue from this. And in exchange, we're going to be doing the underwriting and the risk management such that if the merchant caves, we're going to be the ones on the hook for it. Now, that third party may or may not have merchant reserves. Certainly, if they have merchant reserves, that would be the first way to try to enforce that debt. If not, it's going to have to come out of that third party's either operating cash flow or some type of reserve that they have. And we've all seen instances where that third party got into trouble and either had to sell itself or take on some loans on unfavorable terms, or taken over by the financial institution, because they're the ones that are ultimately going to backstop it. And in the case that they're unable to backstop it, which has happened before, I don't know if you remember, what was that, the Bank of Metropolis? Even Superman could not save the Bank of Metropolis, which was taken down because of its acquiring organization. And in that event, then it goes out, and the other parties within the ecosystem had to participate. Now I think it just stops with Visa and MasterCard.
It's all about, do you have enough ass in your pants? Because if you don't have enough ass in your pants to cover the liability associated with what it is that you're doing, somebody else either has to have a stopgap behind you. So that's going to either be, so if you start with the merchant, as Ken said, and then go to the ISO, and then you go to the bank, you know, if you were not, you know, that's kind of the way that flows. And as Ken said, you can have reserves. In most cases with higher risk businesses today, there are going to be reserves either with generally with the acquiring institution. But that's the way it works. And I mean, you got to realize the banks are sitting out there and they're allowing ISOs to process, underwrite, do risk. They are doing oversight and they are managing them on a day-to-day basis, but that's at a very 100,000 foot level. So they're really taking into, you know, they're really expecting this ISO to be doing what they're supposed to be doing. And when generally you have an ISO that ends up doing something that he's not supposed to be doing, allowing a merchant into the system that he shouldn't allow into the system, or allowing a merchant to do something once he's in the system that he shouldn't be, that's when you get into trouble. And it, like Ken said, it's generally the first person to run off. I think we should talk about that. Who's the first person to run off? It's always the merchant. It's always the merchant. Some of the things that I think that people are not really understanding today with regards to this are things like fines from the card associations, especially today when we're talking about cash discount or we're talking about dual pricing or whatever it is that you want to talk about. Visa has somebody go into the Quickie Mart. The person at the Quickie Mart runs a transaction. They surcharge a debit card in whatever form that is. Visa steps in, sends out a letter that says, you can't do that. The merchant says, I promise I won't. I raise my right hand. Everybody says, okay, let's save the poor merchant. He's good to go. Well, guess what? The merchant does not change how he's operating. The Visa goes back in there. Visa runs another transaction. They surcharge the debit card again. And guess what? Then there's a $5,000 fine or something along those lines that comes down from the card associations that goes to the bank. The bank passes it to the ISO. The ISO goes to pass it down to the merchant. Guys, what are the odds that the Quickie Mart that processes $10,000 a month is going to be able to afford to pay a $5,000 fine? They are very, very thin. Generally, what's going to happen is the merchant's going to say, it's cheaper for me to shut down the Quickie Mart and go across the street to pay the $5,000 fine. So the fine then gets turned back to the ISO. The ISO has to pay it. If generally they can. If they can't, then it's going to go back to the acquirer.
So in that example, what you just shared had nothing to do with the amount that they processed. And the reason I think that's interesting is because when you consider the fees and fines from entities like the card networks, as well as some of the potential governmental entities out there, as well as potential litigation against some of these third parties, the actual amount of the loss can be many times greater than the amount of merchant processed. And mm-hmm. So a lot of times someone will look at this and say, well, I have no risk. I'm 100% reserved. That doesn't take into account some of the examples that I just shared and the example that you just brought up.
Yeah, fines can be very hefty. The brand violations and whatnot, we've seen some of those with Nutra when there's something that shouldn't be in the product, that kind of thing. That's not, you know, a laughing amount that you, it's not just something that we say, oh, no big deal. Those can be very big amounts, and there's not necessarily, it's not always well defined. The card brands set the amount based on what they think the amount should be. There's no rule that says they're processing this much, we're going to fine them this much.
When it goes back to, like we just said a minute ago, look, it's not always you've let a bad actor into the system that causes liability with whatever it is that they're processing, because that could cause a problem. It can be, like we just said, the merchant acting in a manner in which it's going to cause a fine. And those fines, you know, we get it all the time, and I'm sure others do as well. You know, we get a notice from Visa, merchant is doing XYZ, and you know, a lot of times we'll just go back and say, hey, the merchant needs to go find a new home. We just don't want to deal with it. Oh, well, Kevin, come on. Let's, you know, he didn't know what he was doing. We didn't educate him properly. He's not going to do it again. I'm sure that might be the case. But guess what? Can we afford for him not to do it that, you know, to do it improperly again? No, we cannot, because his capability of paying for that is slim to none.
Yeah, and when you think about just the tax that goes into all of the other activities that have to be done when you have a situation, right? You described a situation from the card networks, which is the least taxing of the oversight authorities. And what I mean by taxing is the additional work that goes into it. If you get a similar inquiry with a state or federal governmental entity, you're going to have to make sure that all of your legal team gets involved in it. Potential documentary evidence is needing to get set aside. And there's just a tremendous tax on the organization to make sure that you're protecting yourselves against some type of enforcement action or, legal suit. I was an expert in a criminal case for the government. And just the amount of effort, the amount of energy that the government put into this case, it just really made me think very clearly about the expression, don't make a governmental case out of it. They just have awesome and enormous resources. And you just don't want to get yourself on the wrong side of that.
Absolutely. And we've been on the other side of that as well, and it's sadly, those are usually closed merchants, ones that we've already told to go away. And either the FTC comes in looking for reserve funds, or the IRS comes in looking for the same because they owe taxes. And then you are left, as the processor trying to manage this, and you're no longer making any money on it. Like you said, you have to consult with an attorney. What do we need to do here? How do we need to go about this? And so you're just trying to cover yourself, and it's not a money-making or revenue-making opportunity anymore. So it's definitely a costly thing that you don't want to get yourself into. So you want to try to weed those out before you even start doing business with them. It's just not always realistic.
And that's difficult to do sometimes. I'm not saying this is the commonplace, but hey, look, merchants do things they're not supposed to do, and they do tell you intentionally they're doing something else so that you won't uncover what they are doing, because they know what they're doing is wrong. And that can lead to a whole lot of trouble. And quite honestly, the FTC is going to come knocking and they're going to say, hey, you facilitated the transaction because you were the credit card processor. You should have known that's what they are doing. And even though they told you they were doing something else and you uncovered that they were doing something wrong and you told them to go away, the prior activity that you allowed them to do, whether you knew it or didn't know it, is still on you.
Yeah, I think we need to have some optimism in this conversation because, effectively at the end of the day, banks and these third parties, we as an industry are charging merchants to get their own money back, right? And so merchants hate paying the discount, but to the extent that you have an appropriate system and an appropriate risk manager, that's how and why the industry makes money. And so there are many examples out there of folks doing it right, doing it well. And, this industry has made a lot of money for a lot of people. And it's by employing appropriate risk management skills, people, processes, technology, all that stuff. And it's a great business and it can be done.
And unfortunately, Ken, you and I and Elena, now that she's kind of been in this for a little bit, but you and I specifically, we've been around for so long and we've seen so much of this stuff, and it's things that you could never imagine were going to happen that actually do happen. And you're like, holy crap, how did that happen?
Yes. All right. Let's say we have an ISO who's looking for a new sponsor bank relationship. We talked about this a little bit earlier, and that we have to make sure that our values align with the sponsor bank. We have to make sure that they're going to be comfortable with our risk strategy and management strategy. But let's flip that around. What is the sponsor bank going to be looking for from us as the ISO? What do we need to have to be able to get into the door at that sponsor bank?
I've had the opportunity to start a few businesses over the years, and I don't want to say that I built a business plan and then followed it, because that is not ever what took place, right? That never happens that way. But if you don't have a plan, you don't know who you are, and you don't know where you are deviating from that plan. So I think on both sides of it, the bank too, needs to have a clear business plan. Who is it that we are? What are our assets? You know, what's our SWOT analysis? And then from that, what's our customer profile? And different banks are going to have different sets of profiles and different value proposition. But I think that's the, you know, the first know thyself. You know, that's how I would look at it as a bank. What are my assets? And then from that, what's my customer profile look like?
I agree. I think also one of the things that people do not take into consideration enough, our industry is extremely small. And there's not an enormous number of acquiring institutions that are out there. Your reputation in this business, especially, you know, previous reputation with previous acquirers, if Synovus wants to find out what you were like when you were with Wells Fargo, they're going to pick up the phone and Wells Fargo is going to tell them. Don't think that you're going to be at one place and be able to go somewhere else and nobody's going to understand or know. Your reputation is going to be a big play into that acquiring bank and whether or not it's willing to move forward with you.
I think reputation and experience, they're going to want to know that you are an experienced operator that is capable of overseeing underwriting risk, you know, running this operation and knowing all the things that you need to do to be able to run your shop effectively and not let bad things happen.
I think you were asking the question, though, from, you know, what is the bank, how do they go about evaluating, right? And I think the bank has to look at what they're bringing to the table and then find the partner that best meets with what they're offering.
Knowing that not everyone that they meet is going to be a good fit. I think we, on both sides, you have to be picky. You've got to look for the
right fit. Kissing a lot of frogs.
Yeah, there's... But that's a good point. I mean, as the ISO, you also need to be aware of what is the areas and the strong suits and the positives of the acquiring institution that you're talking to. Is that the right institution for you, for what you're doing? There are different institutions out there that have different levels of risk. There's different institutions that have different pricing. There's different levels of autonomy with different institutions. So you need to find one that fits you and fits you well.
So if we're talking about being picky, the reason that we want to be picky is that there are some things that can go wrong with sponsor banks. So I know that you had a specific experience with this, Ken, and I would love for you to share that experience just so we can kind of get an idea. We also had one we'll share as well, but just so we can get an idea of what might go wrong and the reason that we should be very selective when we pick an acquiring institution.
What's the old analogy? It's not just who your partner is, but it's who your partner's partners are.
Most definitely.
Yeah, same thing. I was running a company that was owned by a bank holding company, and what befell us had nothing to do with the merchant services organization. It had to do with their mortgage portfolio. And so certainly you have to evaluate the size of the institution that you're working with and understand, you know, if that bank were to fail, which has happened now, right? We've all seen that happen. Mm-hmm. You know, what that will mean to you and what the assets and liabilities of that bank looks like. And so another, institution that has recently been in the news is the Synapse bankruptcy. And what happened to the banks, or what's happening to the banks that we're working with Synapse. And I think that's going to have a chilling effect on their portfolio. There's another bank that recently just said, hey, we're not taking new merchants, right? Came suddenly out of left field. But you could be running a very clean, pristine portfolio. But if you're with a bank that has some challenges, your business might be impacted. And so you need to think about, do I need to have some type of redundancy? How do I go about protecting myself or my financial institution to get into trouble?
And it does happen. People don't understand. It's not just that, you know, you're worried about the bank failing. The bank could have a change in senior management. And if it's a smaller bank, the nice thing about a smaller bank is they can move quickly and effectively and efficiently in changing and adapting new things. They can also decide to get the hell out of the business quickly, effectively. And there's nothing that you'll ever get in your contract that's going to say, you know, if the bank decides that they want to get out of the processing business, that they really have to give you any consideration whatsoever. They'll never give you that in a contract.
Or the feds decide that the bank has to get out of the business for them, which is what happened to us. And unfortunately, it happened to us in month, what, Kevin, six?
It was about month six when we had our 37th merchant on board. And we were not, you know, we were just getting started. It was with a financial institution that was rather small in the Northeast. And what happened was they failed their Fed audit. And the feds, one of the things that came out of that was the feds told them they did not have enough institutional control. They could not be in the acquiring space, and they needed to exit. And they needed to exit yesterday. And we literally got a phone call on a Friday afternoon that said, "Hey, Kevin, I hate to tell you this. You can't send me over any more apps. I can't process. And as a matter of fact, we've got about 120 days to get your bin transferred to another sponsor." That was a hectic time for us. And it kind of came out of the blue. This is a bank that I had done business with for years.
Wow. How many merchants did you have at the time?
I think we had a couple of hundred at the time. But prior to that, in my previous venture with that bank where we had a bin, we had 22,000, 23,000 merchants with that acquirer.
So, but that was just kind of at a very pivotal time for Secure, right? And then
absolutely.
You guys got the call
six.
And said, "You got to go."
You know, you spend all this time prepping. You know, we'd spent probably close to 6-7 months getting everything ready to launch. 6 months after the launch, the bank calls up and says, "You got to go." It's nothing that we did. It was not anything, quite honestly, that any of their other ISOs did, which I think they only had one or two other ISOs at the time. But it was something that someone had done over in the ACH department at the bank that allowed transactions to take place that they shouldn't have allowed to take place.
And try taking a tiny portfolio like that as a startup with a weak balance sheet to a new sponsor bank and see what the reaction is. That's when, you know, Kevin, you were talking about earlier, reputation is everything. That's when reputation is absolutely everything, because you don't have the balance sheet to back it yet. You're a startup and you're losing money hand over fist because you can't board new business. So we were fortunate in that case to be able to hop over to Synovus, but that's not always the case. They're looking for a number of things, some of which we didn't have at the time. So it came back to reputation.
Your point is that doesn't happen quickly, right? Because when in my situation, at first, the bank was doing so poorly, they said, "Okay, we need to sell this business." And so we started a sales process and then had to manage the employees as we told them we were going through a sales process. Then the bank fails, have to manage, you know, 100 people as we were going through a takeover by the FDIC. We had to explain, because it was publicly disclosed. We had to announce that to our customers, the impact on them, and our salespeople, trying to keep everybody together so that we could continue on in the business. And really what we were looking for is a lifeline or a buyer at that point. And we went through a sale, and that sale failed to take place. A company paid me $2 million not to acquire my firm. Long story. I won't go into the details, but first time I was ever paid money not to be acquired. We were so far down in the process, and then they backed out of it. So they paid us $2 million not to proceed.
We had a similar situation when I was at Pipeline Data. We were going through an acquisition and got to the 11th hour and decided we did not want to go through with the acquisition. And the private equity firm that we were with at that time had to pay the acquired party to go away.
So
if you're the acquired party, hey, you're excited.
Well, we weren't excited because we didn't have, you know, that means we were going back to the FDIC.
Yeah.
So.
Yikes. And that's never fun.
Well, Ken, I also think that's very interesting because you're one of the only people I've ever met that actually has gone through this transition and actually was absorbed into a federal agency, so to speak, and working with a federal agency that had to be quite the change and probably was quite the education process, not only for you, but also for them.
Oh my gosh. So I still stay in contact with the federal, the officer that took over. He was a good guy, right? And his first day he came in and goes, okay, how much money do you guys need? Do you guys need to keep to stay afloat? And we're going, what? He goes, yeah. How much money do you guys need to run this business? Well, we make money. And he goes, oh. it was amazing how foreign we were to him. And you know, then we all got signed up on the FDIC's payroll, and we got overtime the first weekend because we were working all hours. They paid us overtime for working. I thought that was hilarious. They told us we couldn't expense alcohol. I said, well, you know, we're courting independent contractors for their business. If we can't take them out for a drink, I don't know what we're going to be doing. So there's just some of the stuff was absolutely hilarious. But anyway,
I guess strip clubs were out of the question.
So yeah, no, that wasn't, that was not something that was even on the discussion block.
Wow.
But it was just a surreal experience.
And this happened quite some time ago, and now we've seen some other things happen with sponsor banks. And what changes have you seen or proposed changes in light of that that might help kind of prevent these from happening, or will they prevent them from happening?
It works in a pendulum, right? And so something happens, it goes way to one side. Obviously, we had this Synapse bankruptcy. And so right now you're starting to see a clampdown on the way that banks manage their third parties. And, you know, just, I think, was it this week? The FDIC put forth a proposed rule with managing the funds of fintechs that are, with banks, right? And, you know, this new rule that's coming down is going to be a lot of additional scrutiny. I think it's going to make it harder for some of the embedded banking solutions to come forth. I guess just one thing with regards to this proposed new rule, it specifically exempts what's called a for the benefit of depository account. And that's the type of account that most banks use today to manage the funds of any third party. So I don't think this rule is going to have an impact on the traditional acquirer space. I think it will have a significant impact on embedded banking and banking as a service offerings.
And Ken, let's talk about that a little bit for just a second, because I know even for me, sometimes that gets confusing when we're talking about that. There are different types of accounts at banks. And I think traditionally in our environment, most of the accounts that we see, such as reserve accounts, settlement accounts, those are, I'm trying to think of, is it custodial accounts? I don't think that custodial is the right word, but the bank is a band control account. Those are accounts that are controlled by the bank. In the fintech world, we have accounts that are controlled by the fintech, which may have multiple deposits and multiple ledgers within that account for different customers, which
right.
are not controlled by the bank, and they're not federally insured.
Well, so this new rule is attempting to put FDIC insurance over those end users. And mm-hmm. and so when I use the term the FBO account, that is equivalent to a bank control account, an account that's mm-hmm. controlled by the bank. The bank reconciles, the bank does the settlement for, and that's the opposite of the custodial account that's managed by the custodian of that account. And so in Synapse's case, Synapse was the owner of that. They managed the subledgers, and the bank didn't have insight into it. And so what this proposed rule is saying is, hey, at least daily, bank, you need to make sure that you're reconciling for these end users the amount of money that they had in their account.
So everyone understands this is what happens when a company is supposedly handling accounts for that is not a bank. They are not a bank. They're a fintech. But they're handling accounts for their customers. And what happens is one day there's supposed to be $1 million in that account, and somebody wakes up and actually does the reconciliation, and they realize it's not $1 million, it's $1,000. That's a yeah. big problem.
And in Synapse's case, what they were doing, they were supplying the APIs to support other fintechs. And so there was, you know, multiple you know, I think oddly named or at least uniquely named fintechs that were utilizing Synapse.
Mm-hmm.
So it just snowballs. It's just an even bigger problem to try to reconcile all of that out.
Yeah.
And that's where I think I've seen the numbers like between 65 million and 80 million in the money that's missing from that. And I guess that's why we have that disparity, because there's so much going on. We don't even know what the number is at this point.
So, Ken, exactly. What you're saying is not only do we have a custodial account, we have pseudo custodial accounts inside of a custodial account.
Yeah. If you were an individual customer, right, you're outraged. And so I'm sure the FDIC is getting backlash because these folks are saying, well, my money was in an FDIC insured account. Well, it was, but that account was only insured for $250,000.
Wow.
So, you know, in some respects, you got to think, okay, what were the disclosures that went out to these customers and were they paid attention to?
Did they go out?
I don't know that side of it. I don't want to opine. Yes.
Well, this has been a great.
I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. Let's put it that way.
This has been a really good discussion, Ken. I would love for you to talk about the kind of consulting work that you're doing now, who you're most typically doing it for, and then if anyone is interested in doing that kind of work for you or with you, rather, how they might reach out to you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. So the type of consulting work that I do is to assist my clients in not needing a consultant anymore, right? So where I want to get them to is on the other side of their specific project with the knowledge, solution, technology, whatever it is that they need, that they can manage the business independently. And certainly I hope to get repeat business from the clients that I work with, but it's not necessarily by maintaining my influence on a specific project that they're beholden to me for. It's to give them the access, abilities, and training to get them so that they can do it more independently. Consultants are expensive, right? We're doing work on an hourly basis. So our time is our treasure. We're gonna charge more for it, but to the extent that we can impart greater value to our clients, that's what I'm looking to do. I do also do fractional executive work, expert witness testimony, and assist with technology road mapping.
Okay. And we'll link your contact information in the podcast. Are you on LinkedIn? Is there a website? How should they reach out to you if they want to contact you directly?
Absolutely. Yes. I'm on LinkedIn under Ken Musante. And I've got a website where I all of the articles I've written since starting Napa Payments and Consulting are available. And the website is NapaPaymentsAndConsulting.com.
And I'll have to add, I love those. You write the best articles for people who really like to get into the details and understand the full picture of what's happening. I know you write a lot of articles for the Green Sheet as well. So if some of our listeners are not currently readers of your articles, I encourage you to check them out because they're great.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's inspiring to hear. And a shout out to the Green Sheet for being kind enough to publish my articles.
Well, Ken, thank you very much for joining us today. You and I always have insightful conversation when we run into each other at the different conferences and have for years. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come out and sit down with us today and kind of go through some of these things that we talked about, the sponsor bank and, you know, hey, taking the time to talk about the things that are going on with Synapse and some of the other things that are out there today and how that's affecting legislation and so forth that's moving forward. So once again, thank you for your time today.
Kevin, you always provide the insight to my fullness. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you.
Thank you.
You guys be good. Thanks for the time.